All right, Ramzi Khalif, what's up, man? Thanks for coming to the show.
Thanks for having me, Azan.
It's great to have you here, man. It's been almost like 2 years since we've been talking and we finally get to meet today. It's been a long time coming. Cheers. It's great to have you here.
Yamas.
So you are officially the first ex-management consultant that comes on the show.
And oh, really?
I've been excited to have you on the show so we can talk a little bit about consulting. You're also the first ex-Kareem. We're going to talk about that, obviously. But you're the third GM / co-founder in the investment app space to be launched in the region. So I already had Sarwa on and Baraka. And I was very excited to have you on because I feel like I've now developed like an expertise in this domain and talking to all these founders. Excited to talk to you about all those things from consulting to startups, investments, and everything in between, and MBA as well. Let's start with Stashaway. Stashaway is the robo-advisory investment app, a global platform. You guys just raised a $25 million Series D, I believe.
Series D from Sequoia.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit, please, what is Stashaway exactly, and where are you guys in the region at this stage?
So essentially, we're a digital wealth manager, or what's more commonly known as a robo-advisor. And so what does that mean is it's a fully digitized platform, and based on your personal profile, so your personal information, your situation, your risk tolerance, et cetera, and what your financial goals are, of course, we recommend a risk rating for you. And that risk rating is tied to a predefined portfolio. And we have 12 existing portfolios that you can choose from currently. We're of course continuing to expand our product offering, but it starts from the lowest risk, which is essentially all bonds, and goes to the highest risk, which is essentially all equities. And we invest and everything in between. And so we invest using ETFs exclusively, mainly to maintain kind of the high liquidity. So you can get in and get out whenever you want, at as close to kind of current market values as possible. So minimizing the spread as much as we can, making sure the volume of the liquidity is there, the tracking error is reduced, et cetera. Mm. And so we invest in bonds, equities, real estate through REITs, and then commodities.
Right. And so when you say you can get in and out anytime you want, does the user actually have the button to say sell position or buy into position or ETF? Is this like, because the reason I'm asking is because when we talk about active investing versus passive, it's an important consideration because it removes the judgment from the user to choose what assets to invest in. But I think another consideration of passive versus active investing is the decision to get in and out of the market with all the volatility that might happen and how somebody has to be emotionally intact in order not to react in a way that makes them lose money. So can users on Stashaway actually get out of their positions and take their chips off the table? Or how does it work exactly?
Yeah, so you touch on a lot of points. So obviously, our philosophy is more on the passive strategy as opposed to being an active investor. So majority of the time, active investors actually underperform their benchmarks. It's something like 80% plus, whereas passive investing with a long-term view, a fully diversified portfolio, at least in Stashaway's case, since we've launched around 4 years ago in Singapore, we've been consistently beating our benchmarks across all of or across majority of our risk portfolios. So when you say close your position or get out, it's not the same as when you're using a broker or investing in individual stocks. So you don't have an open position or a closed position. You're not short selling. You're not doing any of these things. Mm. You're investing in a predefined portfolio that's a group of ETFs, anywhere from 7 to 12 in each of our different portfolios. And we recommend that you kind of hold... think of the long term. So all of our portfolios have a minimum 3 to 5 year kind of view. So we advise that you don't kind of get distracted by the short term noise or volatility of what's happening in the market. It's extremely difficult to time buying in and buying out. So obviously you want to buy low, sell high, but the reality is it's extremely difficult to do so. And so we see that by professional fund managers, active fund managers, where they underperform their benchmarks consistently year on year.
Yeah.
But having said that, of course it's your money. You need access to it whenever you want for whatever reason you want. Mm. So we don't have any lockup period.
Right.
It's really up to you whenever or as often as you want to transfer in to invest. We recommend making that as an automated process. So automated transaction on your monthly bank statement, online banking, as soon as you receive your salary. But at the same time, if you do want to get out for whatever reason, the risks has changed, you need the money, you want to buy a house, you want to send your kids to school, you've retired, whatever it is, and you want access to some or all of your capital, it is as simple as clicking a button And then that money comes back to you within 1 to 3 days, which is just a typical transaction timelines.
Fair enough, fair enough. Unlike a hedge fund where you have a lockup period for institutions and other high net worth individuals. Yeah, I think that as a retail investor, I would like to have the freedom and option to do it. And also, you know, the ability to emotionally control myself, not to get out if I feel like I want to get out of the market. Today, we saw a huge crash in crypto. Just the last hour since you got here, you know, all the crypto that I'm holding, which is a lot, went down by 40%. So it takes a lot for people to watch. Stocks, same thing happened last year. It crashed by 40% within a day, within a week rather. Let me ask you another question. What are the differences between the different robo-advisory apps that are out there? We've all heard about, I mean, the term robo-advisory is a relatively new one to the region. There have been wealth managers, and today there is, you know, Sarwa, Baraka, and I guess Stashaway, and these are only the three that I know about. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more how Stashaway might be different from the other apps, or what makes one app different from another in this space that is robo-advisory that's launching in the region.
Yeah, so essentially when you're talking about robo-advisory or digital wealth management, I think at a high level, everyone is trying to solve essentially the same problem. So in principle, they're kind of offering you more or less the same thing. When you go down to it, there do become key differences. I'll focus more on what our value proposition is and what our kind of differentiators are. So for us, it's our investment framework is kind of the key thing. So we have what we call the Economic Regime Asset Allocation Model, or ERA for short. And that was put together by our chief investment officer, who's an investment veteran, 20 plus years kind of investment experience. His last role before joining as one of the co-founders of Stashaway and chief investment officer was global head of derivative strategy for Nomura. Very numbers, very quant guy. So our investment framework, our algorithm is basically developed, or he's the brains behind it essentially. And so what that does is takes modern, it's based on modern portfolio theory, but augments it through different things. So we call it, or I call it at least, like strategic passive investing, because you want to be as close to the efficient frontier as possible to maximize your potential returns at each different risk level. And so you can't really look at an infinite number. In theory, you can, but it's in practicality is very difficult to look at infinite number of different securities to develop that efficient portfolio. But what we do is, based on our strict criteria of what we want to include as the ETFs, which I talked about a bit earlier, so the liquidity, the volume, the tracking error, the bid-ask spread, et cetera, we have currently 33 different ETFs that we do track. And each of our portfolios, which I mentioned we have 12 of, is a different combination of those 7 to 12, is a different combination of 7 to 12 of those different ETFs. So we don't have any one portfolio that's identical or exactly the same. There obviously will be some ETFs that kind of overlap in the different portfolios, but with different weightages, but none of the portfolios are exactly the same in terms of the underlying assets themselves.
Right.
So we have 12 different portfolios that you can choose from. You can hold multiple portfolios, so you can hold more than one because you may have different financial goals as well. So planning for your retirement is different to buying a house, is different to saving for your kids' education, is different to buying a car. And so though each one of those will have different timelines and then by definition, different risk tolerances as well.
Got it. So for those listening and watching, ETFs, exchange-traded funds, already themselves include a basket of assets. So you'll have, I guess you could even think about the S&P and NASDAQ and all those as some form of ETF. So the way that you guys go about it is that you mix different ETFs. So you're mixing different baskets of stocks together based on the appetite of the investor in terms of the risk and the desire, the return.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So an ETF is diversified in itself.
Right.
But it's not, if you want to build an efficient portfolio, you want to be able to combine more than one of those ETFs because that's what pushes the efficient frontier outwards.
Right. And so that's one of the things you guys are doing at Stashaway that other robo advisories or
so. It's what we do. It's not that what I don't know what others are or are not doing in that space. This is what we do. And our investment framework is a proprietary investment framework that we've kind of developed internally. And so that's kind of our key differentiators. And we've seen, of course, historical performance is not an indication of future performance per se, but historically we've outperformed our same risk benchmarks across our portfolios.
Fair enough. Cool. We were talking earlier about like all the different forces and drivers that are moving the market nowadays. And I had mentioned in a previous episode, you know, typically you have fundamental analysis and technical analysis. And there's always been this hype and social media effect or all the chatter that goes on in the background in terms of moving stocks. My personal view is that this has become one of the biggest drivers today, not just in crypto where it's huge, but also in stocks, like we saw that with GameStop and AMC and everything else. To what extent do you totally, you know, isolate yourself from all of that and be like, we're just choosing ETFs, we don't like listen to the social media hype? Or do you take that into consideration nowadays, given how important it's been playing a factor?
So today it's a good point, and it's becoming a lot more prevalent, and you don't want to underestimate the power of the masses, because they can't, like we've seen it, GameStop is just the most popular example today, but we've seen it many times over. Elon Musk with Dogecoin, and people kind of start to want to predict what he's going to say and how it's going to move, and it doesn't always go according to their plan either. So using that and using their behavior to predict future movements is also, it's not so easy to do.
Right.
You can have your models and estimates and assumptions and all of that, but it's not so straightforward, and you will be proven wrong at some point.
Right.
So it's not that we ignore it, it's that we look at the broader market and we look at the broader portfolios. And so when you're talking about any one individual asset, it's not typically enough to move entire markets together kind of up or down as one security.
Mm.
That once they get more, maybe they get more creative and they start buying the SPY or like the S&P ETF, and you're driving that upwards and downwards, and what implications that's going to have on the actual underlying securities, and then how quickly can the portfolio holders or the ETF holders mimic that kind of movement. That's where it becomes kind of very tricky, very interesting.
Fair enough. And then you were also saying that in the different portfolios that you have for your customers, it's not just equities, you have also bonds and rates, real estate, investment trusts. Is this one of the things that as a user I could choose to be like, can I get a product that is only US stocks, or if I'm going to get a portfolio, I have to get whatever is included in that portfolio?
So the way the product is built today, you're tied into what that portfolio consists of. So a lot of people, some people do come to us and say, this portfolio is great, but I want less exposure to gold, or I want more exposure to kind of US equities or whatever it is. So today we don't have that capability for that level of customization.
Mm-hmm.
In an ideal world, that is what we want to move towards. So for you to be able to give us certain parameters, and then based on those parameters, whether it's something I want or something I don't want, to then build an efficient portfolio around that.
Mm-hmm.
Because for us, the most important thing is to be able to build you the most efficient portfolio at that given risk level.
Right.
So when you take an existing portfolio and you say, I want to remove this or I want to add this to it, you change the fundamental structure of it. Sure. And so you're no longer necessarily aligned with your level of risk tolerance, which is kind of like the basis of how all of this works.
Cool. Fair enough. I was thinking to myself, like I've started a tech startup in the past. I understand how tough it is to grow a consumer app, whatever it is, fintech, social media. Mine was actually social media. I was trying to compete with Facebook and Reddit. So that was very tough. But it's hard as it is to just grow an app and grow usage and traction. But in the robo-advisory space, it's not just about getting people to download the app and use it, but it's also about changing their habits towards saving and spending and getting into the habit of putting money away. Like I was saying the other day, like in Dubai, we're just used to being spoiled, like, and we spend much more, relatively speaking, compared to other people. Mm-hmm. So what sort of, you know, discussions do you have with your team here, not just about putting the word out about Stash Away as an app, but also about how do we change the behavior of people to start saving money and managing their wealth with Stashaway or otherwise, but like, of course, with
Stashaway. Regardless. I mean, these are good behaviors that everybody should kind of, it's good habits that they should get into and get disciplined about regardless.
Right.
So it's good that you brought this, because education for us is a huge thing and extremely important in what we do. And we do it through a number of different ways. So we have what we call our in-app academy, where it's within the app or the web interface. You need to be a customer, but you don't need to have invested. So it doesn't cost you anything to kind of join the platform and then try out these different things. And so that explains a lot of the different topics: financial wellness, how to invest, financial planning basics, how to diversify your investments, how to plan for your retirement, financial plan B, and then other things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way we do it. We have also a weekly or biweekly webinar that we go online to talk about these topics. And then we always give people the opportunity to do a live kind of Q&A,
mm-hmm.
to be able to ask us questions that either we have not answered directly in the content or in the presentation, or stuff that's kind of more personal to them so that they can get that kind of one-to-one interaction, one-to-one advice, as opposed to just a purely digital interaction where it's almost cookie cutter, but to get the information that you want, you need to either dig or read a lot more about. But we also have a number of articles that we do online. And then the last thing that we do around that is what we call the financial wellness program. And so we do that with companies. So it's a complimentary service that we engage with employers on to educate and empower their employees around the whole concept of financial wellness, which is, like you said, extremely important, especially in this part of the world where people, a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck. They spend spontaneously. They go on kind of luxury holidays. They do things that they may not otherwise do because they're lured in by the tax-free income or whatever else it is, the easy access to credit cards. So you'll say, I'll spend it now and then I'll pay it off later, whatever it is. So we go into companies to kind of not tell people what to do or what not to do. At the end of the day, it's your choice. It's your money. It's your life. But educate you on what the trade-offs are. So if you want to engage in this kind of behavior, this is what it could mean in terms of events of potential or your contribution to your retirement plan or these kind of things. And so we go into a lot of these topics with them, and it's more of a curriculum as opposed to kind of a one-off. So we, the every single company, we've been doing this in Singapore for the last 4 years since we've launched, and in here since we've launched as well in the MENA region. And every single company so far that we've engaged with has asked us to come back to do a second or third session on kind of multiple topics because of the strong engagement and the strong appetite that people have, because it really does fit into the whole kind of employee wellness, which is mental health and financial. They all kind of go together because they all impact each other.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things where you only realize what where you could have been in hindsight if you tried to manage your wealth with a little bit of discipline, let's say. It's like with weight loss, it's the same thing, right? So you always kick the can on starting a diet or getting fit, same with saving money. So it's a very, you know, when it comes to managing somebody's money, as somebody who's been bad at saving up until like 5 or 6 years ago, I was horrible. I mean, I wasn't even necessarily living check to check, but I would just find ways to blow through my money because I didn't think so far, I wasn't able to think that far ahead. So if you guys manage to actually get, if nothing else, people to become more to have that, to zoom out and see their life when they're 50, 60, 70, 80 years old, and understand that they need to have their wealth managed until then, that's a noble mission to achieve. It's hard to change behavior. I mean, even with Uber and Kareem, which we can now talk about, who would have ever thought that your main form of transportation would be hailing a ride on an app? And today, I can't even imagine, you know, a taxi is the second best option to an Uber or a Kareem.
And here you almost don't have that option anymore, right? You, to order a taxi, you have to use the Kareem app, unless you're willing to go downstairs and just wait in the street to try to find someone.
Because that's the only way they could have gotten it to work, right? I remember there was a time where Uber and Kareem drivers were getting fined for running, and you know, people had to lobby with the regulator and whatever, and now they had to be part of it. Otherwise, they just can't play the game anymore, right? The taxis were out.
Yeah, this is the power of the disruptor, right? So at first, they keep trying to close you down, not allow you to kind of take that control, because it impacts a lot of people and it has a lot of money involved as well.
Yeah.
But once you realize that it's a technology that's here to stay and it really does have potential benefits if used correctly and you engage in a collaborative way, this is when you can really unlock a lot of potential. And that's what I think both Uber and Kareem kind of did quite well here, especially in the working with the RTA to make it fully online and easily accessible for everybody.
Yeah, it's kind of like a game theory, where like if you know, there comes a certain point in time where everybody has to win, or otherwise somebody's going to lose at the expense of somebody else, right? Tell us a little bit about Kareem. You left. We're going to talk about management consulting, but you joined Kareem just at the right time. A lot of people are in the corporate world employed. It's a very idealistic dream that everybody has to leave a job where they're getting a salary, even if it's a very good salary, to join the startup that will exit. Of course, that's not the only consideration when you move to a startup. You want to join a team, you like a product that you believe in, a mission and all of that. But from a financial perspective, it's always about getting into a company, getting the equity, taking a cut in the cash comp because you know this company is going to exit. And you joined Kareem, I think, 2 years before it exited. Is this correct?
Yeah, more or less.
So take us through the journey from how you decided to join Kareem or how they got to finding you all the way to, you know, believing in this company and then being there when it exited and how like that, I'm sure, I would imagine, I mean, I'm very curious to hear from you like how celebratory that moment was in your life to have joined the startup that actually exited. So take us through the journey, because I want to, like, I think there's some lesson out there for people who might be looking for inspiration on what it means to, you know, look, scout out for companies and startups to join, and how, like, the finish line can be so rewarding and gratifying. So take it away.
Yeah, so it was an interesting journey, to be honest, and a lot of fun as well, a lot of learnings. So I previously was, before joining, I was a consultant. Before that, I was in finance. We can talk about those later also.
Yeah.
But so I knew at the time when I joined consulting, I didn't want to be a career consultant. And I spent a few years there. I learned a lot. It was great, great overall experience. Learned a lot, both good and bad, but always good, but always learnings at the end of the day. And I wanted to get into kind of tech startup-ish. And I say ish because when I joined, it really wasn't, it was well-funded enough for it not to be considered a real startup anymore. So it wasn't the same risk level of joining a really early stage pre-seed or like Series A or something like that, where you really need to worry about the cash capital that you have and how long that's going to last to keep the lights on and be able to pay the salaries and all that stuff. So it was obviously still a big risk because I took a hit on comp. I took like everything like you just described, which is expected. I joined them in the strategy team, which was also kind of a natural exit for most consultants as well.
Right.
And I started working on market strategy, specifically on Egypt, which was the second biggest market at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the reason I wanted to leave consulting as well was I wanted a bit of better work-life balance. I didn't want to travel as much.
Right.
And then lo and behold, a few months after I joined, I'm expected to go to Egypt and literally spend a few months there to kind of like help work like on the ground very closely with the team to turn around certain situations kind of like help build the product and build the market over there. So it didn't really, so it was a bit funny from that, like from that perspective, but again, still a great learning experience, learned a lot. And then when I joined, it was, I'm trying to remember, I think it was only like half or three quarters of one of the floors in the building. And then by the time I left, we had, I think, three or four full floors plus parts of other floors as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the growth, not just in the valuation, not just in kind of like the revenue or the number of rides or trips or whatever you want to call it, but even also in the number of employees globally and in our head office, what we called Basecamp, grew a lot. And so managing that growth as an organization is very tricky and one of the keys to kind of being able to be successful as well. So after my stint as in the market strategy team, I was still within strategy, but focused more on organizational strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So think of like org restructuring, business transformation. So more of this kind of stuff.
Was Aura with you?
She was. We weren't on the same team, but yes, we were both at Cream at the same time.
Yeah, sorry, continue.
So then getting into like the depths of the business itself, how the people are interacting, how are you communicating, how is the senior leadership leading by example, how are the new people, the new joiners, are they living up to the culture? Because it's culture really is kind of a key for that success as well. And when you're smaller, I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's definitely easier to maintain that kind of culture and hire the right people that have that shared mindset, as opposed to when you're growing exponentially and you really need to fill boots on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's not as easy to get that. So then that's where things kind of start to dilute a little bit, not become as like, I don't know, I want to say like family style when you're thinking of like startup. The closeness and like the startup of like a smaller startup. But from a business perspective, very interesting challenges to kind of like figure out to manage through, et cetera. And then after that, I got into the, after successfully going through like a few of those projects, then got into the commercial side of the business, which if I started my career, it's not something that I thought I would be kind of getting into.
Mm.
I was more finance and I got into consulting, strategy, stay kind of like advising people on how to kind of like best do things. And then it's very different when you're the one actually coming up with the strategy and implementing the strategy and then figuring out, oh, this is not really working. Now what do I need to do to figure out to get it to work?
Yeah.
Who do I need to interact with? What do we need to change? How do we need to get the buy-in? How do we need to like the investments or resources that we need? We need to work now in a cross-functional collaborative team.
Yeah.
So very different to what we were doing before, but equally, but again, a different kind of set of learnings. And then going through the organization as it kind of matured and got, went through these different stages, you see that how things evolve and how easy it is actually for companies to lose that focus and fall off and then not, end up not being successful. And so you were saying that you want to join, one of the reasons people want to join startups is partly because of the equity potential.
Right.
So you're accepting a cut in your kind of cash or like today comp in the hope of earning something significantly more, ideally, in the future.
Yeah.
And so that's also something that's never guaranteed, especially with a startup, no matter how well-funded you are. And we've seen that with WeWork and other companies as well, right? So just because things are going well doesn't mean it's a sure thing. And so you need to work hard and make sure that you believe in the founders, in the culture, in the mission, in the strength of the company and contribute to it to be able to get it to be that successful.
Yeah, I mean, I always wondered what are the key success factors for a company to exit despite all those challenges. And there's no one obvious answer, right? Because it's a lot of the product market fit and, you know, the your position in the market, the team. It's not one person's job, it's a whole team. The founders obviously play a big role in being, you know, I have so much respect for founders who are so laser focused on the finish line and can filter out all the noise, you know. It's a very commendable skill, but it takes a level of trust the outside of the contracts and outside of what you see to make a judgment call on a company based on what you know. And by the way, Mudassar Sheikh has a very strong reputation. And one thing about him is he's a very humble guy. I've never seen him like he's not the kind of guy who's very vocal and present. And, you know, he's on the down low. But everybody I know who worked with him seems to say a lot of great things about this guy. Like one guy, venture capitalist Khalid Alhouni, who was part of WAMDA, who invested in Kareem, he said that Mudassar is one of those guys, word for word, is that you just want to keep, if he asks for more funding, you just throw it at him, you don't ask. And so what is it about Kareem that you think was the key success factor for, it's the biggest exit, arguably, in the region, like founded in the region, biggest exit. The whole basket of companies that exited in the region, I think there's maybe 7 or 8 that are like unicorn or close to unicorns or a couple $100 million. And but Kareem is that story. So what do you think, from being there, what do you think was the 1 or 2 or 3 key success factors that got it there? And what was it like to be there when the announcement was made that you guys have been bought out by Uber?
Yeah, so that announcement, that was probably, so we used to have like monthly town halls.
Yeah.
In kind of like the common space. And it was always well attended, but you always have stuff to do. You always have work to get done. There's always something happening, right? So not everybody can always attend. That day when Mudassar made that official announcement, like there was always rumors running around, people talking, asking. But when he made that actual announcement, I've never seen, like it was, I think almost every single employee was crammed into that space. And I told you, we were on multiple floors, right? Yeah. So imagine all of that going into one section of one floor. They were overflowing into the hallways next to the elevators. Everybody was trying to listen. We started putting up screens around so people can like see and hear like everything that's happening. And obviously everybody was super excited, super happy because at Kareem also, they were one of the first to offer equity to all. I don't know at what point, if it was continued throughout the entire time, but initially at least, they were one of the old few that were offering equity to all employees regardless of the level.
Oh, nice.
So everybody got to kind of
be part of it
and be part of it and enjoy that at varying scales, of course.
Right.
So that was a super cool kind of moment because it wasn't the end, but it showed that a lot of all the hard work that you've been putting kind of now is being realized into something. And of course, the journey continues. Kareem is still there.
Yeah.
It didn't get absorbed by Uber. It's still an independent subsidiary. So it's also a testament that a brand like Uber International, so huge, and at the time, this was before their IPO, so people were talking about potential $100 billion valuation at the time almost. They wanted to buy us and... It was a super cool experience. So when you ask about what's the key success factors? Yeah. What's like that secret sauce? There's no one thing. I think in Kareem's case, one of them was that Mudassar specifically, but all the founders were extremely inspiring leaders. So like every meeting that I had, I'm speaking about myself at least. I'm sure other people agree, but I can't speak on everybody on their behalf.
Yeah.
Every meeting I attended to with Mudassar, I left thinking, wow, this like. he's right, we have to do this, no matter what, it's going to work, we can figure it out. Like, is it the level of inspiration, the level of energy, it just doesn't stop.
That's fascinating.
So it's that was, and it's very infectious. So it's not like someone
telling you. You pass it on to your teams.
Yeah. So it's not someone telling you, you have to do this, and like that's it, and you're like, oh, okay, fine, I'll do it, I'll figure it out, like, yeah, whatever. It's, he gets you to believe in it, and then you translate that, or hopefully you are able to translate that kind of in your work and with other teams and the customers and vendors and whoever it is that you're kind of interacting with, for them to be bought in into it as well. So I think in Kareem's case, that was one of the, for me personally at least, that was one of the biggest things.
Absolutely. I mean, by contrast, in most cases, in the world of consulting, where a lot of times, at least with me, I found myself having to do work that I was not convinced I needed to do. But I had to do it anyway, and it was delivered to a level of quality that was good enough or even better than that, but it was not done with a level of buy-in from me individually. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing when a founder of a startup that you work for, or even a partner in consulting, can get the team to buy into the story and the problem that you're trying to solve, because it, not only does it create authenticity in the work, but like 100%, you're going to get better results out of your team when they truly believe in it. No, they're not pretending to actually believe in it. So when you're somebody who's seen what it is to work for a startup like Kareem that exited, and you were there leading strategy but also implementation, which is very different from defining a strategy or designing a strategy in consulting, which is we did a lot of that in our past careers. To what extent would you attribute moving on to consulting here, but also by contrast to your experience in startups, to what extent would you attribute like the skills and the wisdom, business wisdom that you have, your resilience, your tenacity, to your management consulting experience compared to startups? Like, if you were to say, this has definitely been much more valuable to who I am today as my experience, is it the startup experience, including Stashaway, or is management consulting, like, which one wins in this comparison, if there was to be one to win?
So... yeah, so it's a really good question. It's not fair to say, I don't think you can say one is better than the other. I think each person is different and each person's experiences are different. And in my case, it's the combination of them that at least I think allows me to be successful, or success can be defined in different ways in the different roles that I do. But consulting definitely plays a key role in that, because it gives you that discipline. It gives you that structure, that critical thinking, what are the things that you should think about? How do you design, how do you solve it? And then consulting is very rigorous in general. So it's notorious for kind of late nights, working under pressure, delivering things that like you never thought you would be able to deliver at the beginning of the project. And then somehow miraculously by the end, it is done and it's done well and the client loves it. And you're just like, this was crazy.
Yeah.
Now I need a break, but this was crazy. So I can talk about a number of different projects like that were interesting, and those like 3-4 a.m. conversations that happened. But it's taking your learnings from the different parts of your career and the different experiences that you have, whether it's personal or professional, and bringing them together in a way that brings value to the organization. That's how I see things, at least. So
yeah, in consulting.
So consulting, it's not just consulting. So consulting is definitely a key part of that. Mm. My time in finance and private equity was a key part of that.
Right.
My time at Kareem also. So like when you're working in a corporate or when you're working in a startup, it's very different to when you're working as a consultant or interacting with the corporate as a consultant also. So the corporate is kind of paying you. You have to do these things. They're paying you a lot of money also as an organization to deliver something. So they're also they're taking it quite seriously. But then when you're in a corporate, you're meeting so many different kinds of people from so many different backgrounds who don't have maybe the same kind of, I don't want to say work ethic, but like the same way of thinking as you. And so then you need to adapt your style of interaction to get them to buy in, to get them to be convinced, to get them on board.
Yeah.
And now with COVID, it's even tougher because you can't do things in person.
Right.
When you're together, it's much easier to just kind of put aside your differences, figure things out, whiteboard the problem, go out and just kind of talk, have a drink, whatever it is that makes you comfortable to bond the team together.
Right.
But when you're doing everything online on a screen and you don't have any natural conversation anymore and everything becomes very transactional,
yeah,
and you're not able to build that personal relationship, it's infinitely more difficult. So that's another aspect of learning that I think in the future will prove kind of extremely valuable as well, because I think we're going to be in a kind of hybrid model in the future, where it's like a mix of digital and a mix of in-person as well. So
yeah,
that's building that skill set and learning how to kind of interact with people in that way will also be very helpful.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was in consulting and the first few client engagements that I had, I think I was only like 25 or 26 at the time, so pretty young, but I was already sitting in a boardroom with like the CEO of a very big company and the, you know, board members of the board and so on. And I think this is one thing, aside of staying up late and doing all this intellectual exercises, which most of them are useless, but they were needed by our clients, just, you know, for different decisions that had to be taken, some slides had to be developed to back them up. And so I understand that now. But one thing about consulting that I find to be very undervalued is this, the fact that, you know, you're thrown in deep waters at a very young age. So by the time you're 30, 35, and you've done a couple of years in consulting, and you are starting your own startup, or you have to pitch investors or so on, you've already had this level of, you're familiar with the level of anxiety to present to a bunch of high-profile people. You've been there before. You had to put a suit on, and you had to kind of figure it out right there in the middle of a presentation if you don't have an answer to a question, and you had to improvise. So you've been put in all these situations, and I feel like it's like a boot camp for any person in the business world or in the path of business. And what is kind of disappointing is that there's this whole thing called management consulting. And I only sort of been lucky to find out about it by talking to some friends and then realizing I should get into that, and I got lucky to get into it. But it's totally discarded. Like today, I mean, yeah, you can go to university and know that you can apply to McKinsey or BCG or Booz or all those firms, but I feel like the path from being a young and curious and aspiring young kid who's in university to get into consulting, or the awareness, like there was a time when I was in Jordan, and you grew up in Lebanon, right?
I actually never really lived. I worked in Lebanon very briefly. I never lived in Lebanon. I've been a very international expat child. I don't know what the third culture child is. What they call it. So
yeah,
between most of the Gulf, Jordan, U.S., Canada, a little bit all over.
So you must have heard a lot. I guess I did for my parents, like being a doctor, engineer, or lawyer are the two paths.
Yeah, this is like, exactly.
I think management consulting, like do a couple of years of McKinsey, BCG, or Booz. And the reason I say this is because I feel like a lot of people start to develop a desire to get into consulting at an older age, when they realize that it opens up all these doors for you. And, you know, we have this company that does recruitment and consulting. And I feel like there's more awareness that should be made, announced or communicated to the younger professionals in the much earlier in their career, that there is this thing called management consulting. You get a couple of years, 3 to 5 years of McKinsey, BCG, or similar on your CV, and you're pretty much set for life. And I don't think people understand the value of that today. Do you agree with this?
So I fully agree, honestly. And I'm aligned with you on that the younger that you do this, the better. So I got in post-MBA, And I don't regret it. I don't regret kind of like the choice that I made, because it's brought me to where I am today, which is where I'm happy. But if I were to go back to my younger self or give advice to my younger brother, or, you know, like a close friend, like someone who's looking up and saying, what do I do now? I don't know. I don't have that clarity. Management consulting, especially if you don't know what you want to do, is a great place to start, because you learn so much. Like you said, you're thrown into deep end. You have so much responsibility. You're interacting with very senior stakeholders from a very young age. You're presenting to them directly. You need to learn how to think on your feet, critical thinking. Like, it's a lot of skills that are extremely important in whatever field that you decide to do after.
Yeah.
And then you can use that as kind of your launching board. So it's yes, a great check on your CV, of course, especially if you're one of the big brands. But whatever other organization that you do get into afterwards, they hugely value this experience. Yeah. And it's also a great way to get into an MBA if that's something that's important for you also.
So how has been MBA, the value of MBA? I have a love-hate relationship with MBAs. I've never done mine. I find MBAs, and I'd love to hear from you, because you went to Wharton, which is the number one business school in the world. Let's talk also about that. So there is the effect of the network that you build there, which is priceless. I think for me, probably the number one value you get out of MBA is the network you build of people and alumni and all that. But as far as the theory and education is concerned, you hear this phrase going around nowadays with the whole Corona thing as well. Like, universities are for certification, not for education. To what extent do you find this phrase to be true? Like, did you learn content at Wharton that you feel like was particularly special that you could have not gotten it anywhere else? Or was it more about the network and primarily?
Yeah, so I disagree with that, Simeon. So, well, I agree that the network is arguably the most important thing that you can get out of it. And that's part of it. That's and you can get into other groups and different things like socially otherwise, but you can't get into a community like that or an online group like that unless you're actually part of it. So it's very difficult, and it really has a value that can't be replicated. That's very difficult to replicate outside. But in terms of the learning, I disagree. I think that you can learn a lot, and at the end of the day, it comes from you and what you want to get out of it. If you just want to get the networking part out and you just want to party and go out and socialize and travel and do all these amazing things, then focus on that and don't focus on the studies. That's okay. That's what you want to do. But don't underestimate the potential for learning. And yes, with Coursera and all the online stuff and the MOOCs and everything like that, you have access to, and you don't even need that. Just with Google, you have access to an infinite amount of theory. But being in a classroom setting with world-renowned professors who know how to engage the class, stimulate the conversation, get kind of the debate going. And it's not just that. It's also who your peers in the classroom are and the diverse backgrounds that they come from. And it's also not very easy to get that diverse mix of people into one room with one objective and then discussing kind of like the same topic or the same case study in whatever class that you're in. So I'll just give you one example from my class, at least, of some of the different backgrounds that people were at. So, of course, you had all the traditional investment bankers, consultants, PE, whatever it is that you want. But we also had people coming from military background. We had Olympic medalists, swimmers and skiers and things. We had authors, people who kind of poets, people who write as their career. We had the creative director of Cirque du Soleil. We had an NFL linebacker. So when you bring all of these people together, the discussions that you can have are completely different than anything else you're going to experience in your life.
Right.
And the reason I'm saying this is because when you read a case or when you see, you're like, oh, this is so obvious. It can only be this, or this is the only way that you can do this.
Yeah.
But it's the only way, and that's obvious to you. So other people, because of their experiences, because of their background, because of whatever else that they've gone through, think their brain is wired differently and they think completely differently to you.
Right.
So you start getting perspectives and you're like, oh, wow, that's actually quite interesting. I never thought, like, there's no way I would be able to think of that if I sat for 100 hours and just like racked my brain a million different times.
I think in general, being in school or university for that matter, the interaction is priceless. There's no doubt about that. My problem is not specific to MBA, but it's more about curriculums and the schooling process that we still have today, which is you go to a classroom, and if it wasn't for those few moments, maybe more so in undergraduate, in MBA, maybe they focus on it more, which is good. But you spend a lot of time receiving content. You're not even engaging. You know, you spend maybe part of the class at the end debating it with your classmates and having that kind of battle of ideas, which is useful. But the idea that you have to still go to a classroom and sit there and receive content when there is far more, you mentioned Google. Like, honestly, some of the stuff on YouTube is way more efficient in passing even a very detailed curriculum to me as a user or a listener. And the fact that I have to go and pretend that I'm paying attention in classroom, which still goes on today, and I have to learn all about all this bullshit that I'm not going to ever use, or it's not only because it means that I pass a test and then this means that I get to get it to a good college. I really have a big problem with how this process continues to exist as it is, and nobody's disrupting it. Like, for me, the way that a school should exist should not be that you go to a classroom and you receive content off of a board by somebody who is like really not charismatic or eloquent. So I'm kind of hoping that if I ever have kids, like, I would send them to a very different way of school, which is more about, as you said, interacting with people and having inspiring people talk to you, not just, communicate to you from the industrial age of the 40s, like content, because at the time there was no internet or so on. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it's interesting you say that, and I'm torn, if I'm being completely honest with you, because you do need a certain, like, it's not that, it shouldn't be kind of one way and just learn and memorize, So I'm a big fan of like the case study debate discussion, which yeah. is like the MBA way. And what's surprising to me is it's proven to be successful. And you have all these MBAs out there, and a lot of them also own schools, by the way.
Yeah.
How come that's not being translated into this, the way schools are taught? And fine, you don't need to change. Maybe, so I started by saying I'm a little torn, because I think you do need it to a certain degree, at least with certain topics and certain subjects, or at least maybe initially, to right. understand the fundamentals, to understand the basics. Someone still needs to explain it to you before you can engage in a discussion and a debate,
right.
Or an educated discussion and debate about it. So it is a balance, but why is it not changing yet? I don't know. Why are we not learning about certain topics like personal finance, how to do taxes, how yeah. to manage your investments, which are fundamental to every single adult, no matter what you do, no matter where you're from, no matter where you live. These are critical skills that you don't learn yeah. in school. You don't really learn in university unless you studied business or finance.
Yeah.
And even then it's superficial, because it's much more about the theory and like the business side of things.
Right.
And then even an MBA, you need to want to get into that and take those courses and join those kind of student groups. And it becomes a lot more self-led, as opposed to these are critical life skills where you said, when am I ever going to need to learn that?
Yeah.
For different people, it's going to be different things, but for like, you need to start trying something. Like people say, oh, when am I ever going to use algebra? When am I going to use like chemistry or physics or calculus yeah. and stuff like that? But if you're not exposed to it also, you don't know if it's something you're interested in
yeah.
and that you want to continue with. So like, it's not as easy as saying, do this and don't do that. But it's, why hasn't it been disrupted yet is a very good question, because
yeah.
it can be both in its approach and in just the different topics that we're being taught as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, or the mapping of the curriculum itself. Like the fact that you still have to go and study, like imagine you were arguably International Baccalaureate or IB is like one of the best high school programs out there. But even that still teaches the curriculum as chemistry, biology, physics, math, their topics, their content. It's I feel like, as you were mentioning, like things, for example, like how do you make this decision making as a curriculum topic? Within it, there is like game theory and math, ethics and morality, which covers philosophy, persuasion, which covers on communication. So the curriculum is just not mapped correctly. It's not mapped to today's world and the future as well. It's content. And content as topics, as subjects, like plant biology or animal biology, like it exists and you can always read on it and study it. But my problem is with the way that when I think about the level of curiosity that I had when I was 18 and 17 and how kids have them today, and how unfortunate it is that this level of curiosity is not fed with something that is useful to the, you know, it needs to be visibly useful to the person that's studying it. Because up until now, like I have a nephew and nieces who are in high school today, and to them, like, you got to go to school and learn this and do the exam because you got to go to college. Like, there is no link between how this is useful and maybe at best some math like algebra and so on. But the disruption, I think, should happen not just in terms of the process, like how much engagement you have versus how much content you receive, but also the way that the curriculum is designed and defined. It's a shame, and I the entrepreneur in me thinks that I want to disrupt the schooling system. I want to create a new curriculum and launch a new school like high school. But I definitely don't want to send my kids, if I ever have any, to the current schooling system. I'd rather teach them on my own with like-minded people who find that teaching them far more useful and relevant things is a better way for their curiosity, which, you know, brains, the kids have a sponge of a brain. Like you go and you torture them with all this bullshit when they could give them so much better material, basically, right? I
mean, yeah. So when you're engaged, when you're excited about something, there's nothing, like nothing will get in your way. Nothing's going to stop you. So the key is, how do you unlock that appetite
yeah.
on a broader set of students and make everybody kind of want to or be excited about this topic?
Yeah.
I think this is the key to kind of, that's the key to making them want to learn more about it. And it's just changing the approach. So when you look back, there's maybe certain teachers that stand out, because even though the topic was maybe more boring or like sterile or whatever it is, you just weren't, if you think about the topic itself, you're just like, this is like a waste of my time. Why am I doing this? But the teacher really made it enjoyable. This is an important aspect of it as well. So it's not just going to school. It's not just going to an MBA. It's not just going to university. It's going somewhere that resonates with you, that has that high quality, high caliber, like faculty that can get that disseminates that information to you in a way that you respond to.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Getting back into Stashaway, which stage are you guys at right now? So did you launch the app? Can I be a user on Stashaway like today?
Yeah, absolutely. So we launched in, or here at least in MENA. So we in Singapore, we've been live for the past 4 years. Here we officially launched in November of last year, so November 2020. Mm-hmm. So we're still early in the journey. We're, let's say, six months in. We still have a long way to go, of course. But the response has been kind of very positive so far. There's a clear appetite for a product like this. To make things easier, to make things more transparent, to make things more accessible, and also to reduce, not to get into like the value proposition things, but like to reduce the transaction cost of things as well. So
is that one of them? Is that one of the value
propositions? So definitely, because even if you want going to go on the do-it-yourself route and you want to invest in interactive brokers and or Saxo or whoever, whatever it is that Robinhood or eToro, whatever it is that you want to do, and you want to just build yourself a passive portfolio of ETFs and you kind of just want to follow the same philosophy and the same ethos. And there's a lot of groups online that do that and talk about that. One of the biggest problems that they face today is the ability to transfer your funds in a cost-effective way, because when you're transacting in US dollars, everything needs to be sent in US dollars basically. Mm. And so it needs to go to the US and then from the US back into wherever it is that you want to send it to. And then you also have foreign currency, costs, fluctuations, depending on again also where you're sending it from. So those also add up and can be quite expensive.
Yeah.
So just to take like, if you plan on investing like $1,000 a month, you're going to be charged anywhere from probably 30 to 50, if not more, dollars in transaction costs just to get your money there before it's even invested.
The wire transfer fees only.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so if you're doing 1,000 and you're being charged 50, that's 5%, yeah, which is basically your expected return or most of your expected return, right? Especially if you're not in a higher risk portfolio. Mm. So it almost defeats the purpose of doing that. So once you have an option to do someone local that has that international exposure, so you can transfer in local currency, which you can with Stashaway, that makes a huge difference because that 5% there is automatically going into basically your pocket. That $50 is not a loss for you anymore.
Yeah, 5% is a lot. I mean, how much anyway do I expect to make on Stashaway in a moderate or even in an aggressive portfolio? What sort of average returns do you communicate to?
So our expected returns probably range from, I need to look at it to get the exact numbers, but let's say like 3% for the low, 2-3% for the lowest risk, and then let's say 12-15% for the highest risk.
So 12-15%, that's not bad at all, man.
Yeah, but it's, again, it's a high risk portfolio. Yeah, so fine. It's you need to understand the risk that you're getting into, the volatility. It's not a guarantee either. There's no such thing as a guarantee in finance and investing.
Of course.
But if you look historically, how our portfolios performed, our lowest risk was around 5.2, and our highest risk was well over 20. Mm. So we've done better than what we've expected historically, yeah, which is great also, of course. But again, that's you can't expect that as to happen every single year, no matter what.
Right.
So that can be your average over a longer period of time, which is what we recommend that you look at. So you shouldn't be worried about what's happening today or 2 weeks from now or 3 months from now or even a year from now, what's happening with your portfolio. You should stick to your investment plan. You should dollar cost average. Keep the long-term kind of view in mind because history has proven that over time, given enough time, the markets will recover. And even if they are down, keep buying in. You average your cost lower, which is to your benefit anyway.
Right, fair. And do you get any feedback from your community or even from your team or investors or other stakeholders that crypto should be one of the things you guys get into?
So crypto, especially when it was booming, I don't know what's been happening now in the past since we started.
Since we started, and maybe it's down another 40%. It's been a crazy day today.
But yeah, people constantly ask us about it. So we're not against it, and it is something that we do continuously look at. But right now, the way things stand, the volatility is too high for us to be able to include it in our portfolios today. So it doesn't mean that we're not excited about it. It doesn't mean that it's something that we want to kind of ignore. Mm. It's there. It's definitely a future asset class. So it's something that we do want to keep in mind, but it needs to make sense in the parameters and the kind of the not the restrictions, but like the things that we look at to include it criteria. Or not. The criteria to include it or not.
So does, but from a regulation perspective, does DFSA, you're registered with DFSA?
We're registered by the DFSA.
Would they allow you to bring in crypto as an offering into your product? Like,
so you have crypto traders that are regulated by the in by the DFSA. They're based in DIFC. You have Rain and the other ones that are based here. So I would imagine yes. Okay. But the most important thing from a regulatory perspective is that you're investing in a product that makes sense for you.
Mm.
So if crypto makes sense for you, then there should be no reason why you can't invest in it.
Yeah.
Especially if we're using obviously legal means to acquire that asset and put it as part of the portfolio as well.
Yeah, and be a legal custodian for it as well. I think my problem with investing is that people have now their expectation of what investing means and what kind of returns you can get has been totally changed since the last couple of years, because the kind of returns that we've been seeing, not just in crypto but also in stocks, makes something like a 5 or 10 or 15% return a year look very small in comparison to what you hear the stories that go around. So, but it's a bad thing, because actually 5, 10 or 15% a year
is great.
But like, you know, I wonder how, I'm of the opinion that after the liquidity pump that happened the last year, with, I think it was like 20% of the total fiat of US dollar that was printed, that exists out there, was printed just last year. I think the numbers are $26 trillion is the USD supply, of which $6 trillion was printed just last year. And so we might be seeing ourselves in a, what might seem like an endless bull cycle across all asset classes. But it's gonna create gamblers out of people. And the average Joe is not going to be an investor anymore. He's going to become a gambler, because he's going to feel like he's missing the train when all his friends and colleagues are making all these returns and he's making 5, 10% a year. And I wonder what that's going to do to the investment appetite, and especially towards speculative assets like Chinese stocks on the NASDAQ or crypto. Do you think we might see a shift from fixed income and blue chip and dividend paying stocks towards growth stocks and crypto, because of the fact that people just can't be left back with the single digit returns a year anymore, and they're gonna FOMO into all the high returning assets? Or
so I don't think so, and I'm saying this because you also want consistency, right? So you want to be able to earn 5, 10, 15 every year, ideally. And the huge spikes you're seeing in crypto in general, yes, you're making over 100% in a lot of cases as well in very, very short periods of time. But like you said, it tends to crash also very quickly. So the volatility is just too high.
Yeah.
And most people don't have that appetite. They can't tolerate that level of risk. And so you end up making emotional decisions. You end up making the wrong decisions potentially. And then it's also all very psychological. So yes, nobody wants to miss the train, especially if you're seeing all of your friends making so much money and you're hearing of all these people becoming crypto millionaires, and suddenly from like this guy literally had nothing or just had a few $100s and now he's driving Ferraris and Bentleys and just going around like throwing money like it's nothing. Of course, it excites you and you want to benefit from that and you want to be part of that journey. But at the same time, not everybody has that risk tolerance. Not everybody knows how to get into it. And as much as the retail investor is going to get into things, and we talked about, I don't know if we talked about GameStop on the podcast or maybe before.
Yeah, before.
it changes the behavior. But you can't discount also the institutional investors that are also in it more for the long term as opposed to the short term ups and downs. So you do have pension funds and the likes, companies investing more money, universities, endowment funds. So you have a lot of money out there also that needs to be in kind of stable, lower risk that can't be in that. So it's going to be a balance. I mean, finance doesn't stay stable forever.
Yeah.
There's always new products that come. There's always new trading tools that come.
Yeah.
It was very hard to predict what happened in 2008. If everybody saw it coming, then it wouldn't have happened in the first place, because the market would just kind of self-corrected automatically.
My hypothesis is that if you guys, for example, at Stashaway, I think it might be a suicide move to do it. But if you were to like launch a product that says, you know, the kind of like the 100% return a year, like, you know, put only money you're willing to gamble here, you probably might see a lot of traction just because people, like, I think from what I can see is a lot of people are just becoming gamblers when they were never.
You probably would, actually, to be completely honest.
You might just get a lot of, even if it's for the spare change, right? So you know, if you go as far as telling people, don't give us like your savings for this product, but put your spare change in this product and put most of your other savings in more stable assets. They're probably going to, the fact that this product exists and it claims that it's going to get 100, 200% a year, which it probably would, will probably create more engagement and get more people because they're going to be part of a story and they're going to talk about it at dinner and, you know, and just that alone is going to be something. You might as well be competing with online casinos and sports betting websites at that point, but it's a way to get customers. And I think that's what customers, there's a desire for speculative assets and just can't deny it. You got to play the game with people now and offering that if that's what they're into, you know, like.
So it's good you say that because it needs to be a balance, right? So just because someone wants it doesn't necessarily mean they should have it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to dictate what you should or you should do, should or should not do, obviously.
Yeah.
If you want to get into kind of speculative trading, if you want to do your own thing, crypto, individual stocks, whatever it is, then by all means, of course, do it. But I would caution you not to put your entire savings or your entire kind of retirement plan or whatever it is into that kind of stuff. So you should segment it accordingly. And if you want to invest in something that has a 1 or 200% potential return, but that means also it probably has potential to lose most, if not all of that, all that capital as well, it shouldn't be a majority of your funds. It should be a small percentage so that if it hits, amazing, awesome, have fun, buffer your portfolio, whatever it is, you know, like enjoy life. If it doesn't, it doesn't derail you completely from your achieving your long-term plans. Because it's a long-term game. So you can't discount the benefits of compound investing, of long-term returns. So go back. Imagine you started saving and investing when you were 22, first job out of university. Oh,
yeah. Retired by now.
Exactly. You would be so far ahead of the game as opposed to starting when you're 30, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45. And now you need to invest multiples of what you would have had to invest
just
back
to catch
then,
up. Yeah.
Just to catch up.
It's
and
crazy.
Then,
it's so painful, by the way. When you buy into a stock that you know you've either owned or could have owned like a year ago and you were at that point where you could have made a decision, it's such a painful feeling when you say like, I'm buying with the same amount of money, like a fraction of those stocks or assets. That's why I think, you know, the more, I wish you all the best and also all other robo advisory apps out there, because if nothing else, like teaching people how to become more financially conscious, that's a very noble mission because a lot of people need that help. I know even up until now, I still do. Like I still find myself not optimizing the way I should go about my wealth. So having this level of education and discipline is great. As you were saying about crypto and speculative assets, one of the guys I was recently talking to is called Jesse Proudman. He is the founder of the first SEC registered robo advisory in the US for crypto. So they do Stashaway, but for crypto. Very and they cool. also have a hedge fund, a quant hedge fund called Strix Leviathan. So they use their quant programming for their robo advisory, and now they're offering that product. And he describes it as liquid angel investing. And I thought, I was like, this is brilliant. This is exactly what it is. The risk you take with crypto is kind of what the risk that you take with angel investing. When you invest in startups at a very early stage, you know, 9 out of 10 are going to fail, and one of them is going to fail. So, but it's liquid, right? So you can never liquidate your investment or $50K or $100K investment in a startup, early stage startup, the way you can in crypto. And that's why it's an attractive asset, because it's not only speculative and has a lot of growth potential, but it's liquid. And that's also a bad thing, because it means that you can lose a lot of money trying to get in and out of the market. I guess, Ramzi, I just want to say thanks a lot for coming on the show. I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to add. We have been doing this for the last like hour. I told you time passes quite quickly. But I want to leave the viewers and the listeners with your website is stashaway.com or stashaway.ae. For anybody that is curious to learn about how Stashaway works, visit the website, get in touch with your team, find out how you can sign up. And thanks again for coming on the show. Hope to have you again, and we can talk about Stashaway's progress in a couple of months, in a year or so. That's basically it.
No, so thank you. Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun. Appreciate you having me, and thanks for interesting talk. I hope everybody else found it interesting as well. Looking forward very much to being back soon.
Awesome. That's a wrap.
Cheers.